The Union Interview with Frank Zappa by Mitch Devine, December 5th, 1985, 3:30 p.m. So half an hour to 45 minutes should be ample time. And I'd like to talk to you first about the new record and the ratings issue, of course. And then if time permits, some questions about your life and your career and some assorted opinions. So, your new album, Frank Zappa Meets the Mothers of Prevention, it's very timely, and you managed to release it very quickly. Was everything except the Porn Wars track already completed?
Yes.
So you had all that waiting in the can, and you just had to do all the grunt work, as you said, getting the voices and everything.
Right.
And you consulted your lawyer, of course, with that track, and he saw no problems with it?
That's right.
What problems did you think could occur?
Well, not whether or not I thought they could occur. I ask other people's advice for, you know, if you hire a lawyer, you're buying his expertise in matters pertaining to public figures and, you know, copyright violations and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you see this record as an attempt to create more awareness and concern about this ratings issue?
Well, see, the thing about the ratings issue is it's not really an issue.
It's
a bunch of bullshit is what it is. And I would like to create more of an awareness about the bullshit that's involved. See, these ladies started off with a premise which is very unscientific. And that premise is that rock music causes suicide, murder, teenage pregnancy, rape, drug abuse, and sympathy for the devil. And, you know, if we're talking about consumer information here, or truth in packaging, which is one of the things that they often refer to, I would say we require some truth in packaging from the PMRC as far as their ideals and their ideas are concerned, because there's no science to back this claim up. And the reason it got so much coverage is the media saw, especially television, saw a great chance to put these little news stories on in the 5 o'clock news because of the existence of rock videos. They would
right.
make rock videos and chop up these colorful little bumpers.
Makes a good copy.
And then the announcer would say, "You decide." Well, the fact that they put it on the air gives the impression that there is a problem, whereas there is not.
So he said, this isn't really an issue anyway. Isn't all this just a cover-up, like a diversion to sneak by this HR 2911, the blank tape tax?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. First of all, it's known under two names. It's also known as the Messiah's Home Taping Bill. 2911 is the number in the House of Representatives, and in the Senate, it goes under the other name. The bill in the Senate has among its endorsers Senator Gore, Cranston, Kennedy, D'Amato. I don't have the bill here, but those are a few of the names of the co-sponsors that I recall from the bill. You'll also note that as of September 19th, the date of the hearings, that Senator Gore was not a co-sponsor of the bill. As of October 30, when they had the first hearing of the Messiah's bill in a Senate committee, he was a co-sponsor.
How much do you think home taping actually affects you, or does it?
Let me finish what I'm saying about the connection between the PMRC and the home taping.
Okay, good.
For some strange reason, a lot of people don't understand how the connection works. Originally, when the PMRC letter, the first letter that went to the RIAA, was delivered, there were 16 signatures on it. And most of the signatures of these women were over the names of husbands who sat on committees that affected the life or death of this legislation for the record industry. So it was a matter of implied extortion. If you don't do what we ask, speaking from the PMRC standpoint,
mm-hmm.
it was like, if you don't do what we ask, then your bill may just experience an untimely demise in my husband's committee. At least that's the way the RIAA perceived it, because I had discussions with Gordikoff about this months and months ago. Gordikoff, in fact, was the one who told me that one of the original PMRC signers was Mrs. Strom Thurmond. And ultimately, this legislation has to go through the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is chaired by Strom Thurmond. So there was an awareness at the RIAA of what the implications of that PMRC letter was. And the bill itself that they're so concerned about, if it passes, will put $200 to $250 million a year more money in the pockets of the record industry. And that's what the hoo-ha is really all about. There's a lot of money there for no extra work. The government will collect it on behalf of the record industry just like a special tax.
Do you think this is going to pass?
Well, let me tell you some of the people who are against it. I mean, I'm not the only one who has said negative things about it. Every manufacturer of blank tape and every manufacturer of home recording machinery, they all hate the thing.
Of course.
What the bill requires is that all of these manufacturers first obtain a compulsory license from the Registrar of Copyrights. Okay? And without this license, they're not allowed to sell the goods in the United States. And prior to selling your licensed goods, the manufacturer has to pay into the Registrar of Copyrights office a royalty. So they have to pay in advance this surcharge before the consumer ever has to pay it. It ties up their capital. And so do you think that they're going to not attach a little premium on top of this surcharge in order to compensate them for the loss of interest on that capital? Because if the bill itself requires a surcharge of 1 cent per minute on all blank tape, do you think that that's all that's going to get passed along to a consumer?
Probably not.
No way. The other thing that you ought to consider is that if the... In the case of the Mathias bill, the surcharge on a single recording device is 5%, and on a double recording device, which is, you know, any double cassette machine or a combination of a turntable and a cassette machine, it's 25%. Do you think that the manufacturers, if forced to do this, will just add 5% and 25%? Right.
I hope not.
So let's talk about the justice of the concept anyway. I believe that if a person earns his living from writing music or performing music, and somebody, and there are established uniform ways in which people get paid for performing this service to society, there are royalty rates, and there are fees connected with established rates of how people get paid for doing this stuff. If somebody thwarts that system or tries to bypass it in some way, depriving the artist of a part of his income that he is reasonably entitled to, I think that's unfair. So in theory, I believe that people, if they're going to consume music, they shouldn't expect people who make the music to do it for free, because nobody else does anything else for free. It may come as a surprise to people in the real world, but musicians also have families, rent, and mortgages. And if you chip away at the earning power of these people, you can put them out of business. And to a certain degree, whenever a person does home recording, for the reason of avoiding purchasing the album, that really hurts the artist. But there's another type of home taping which I think is okay. And that is, let's say you bought the album and you want to listen to it in your car, but you don't want to buy a commercially manufactured cassette because you know that if you buy that cassette, it's probably going to fall apart after 15 plays because it doesn't have any top end on it. You know, as an audio connoisseur, I would probably say that you'd get a better recording on your cassette machine if you did tape it off the album on a high-quality TDK cassette or something like that and made it in real time instead of at high-speed duplication like they do for commercial cassettes.
Right.
It would sound better. But at that point, the guy has already spent the money for the album, and if he wants to enjoy the music on it, I would find no objection to a person taping off of his own album for his own home use. The real objection that a lot of people have to home taping is the practice of people borrowing albums from somebody else, taping them, and then not buying the album. And in a way, that cheats the person who's made the album, the guy who publishes the music, and the record company. They all lose money on that. But I think that the amount of money that they have talked about in this bill for compensation is probably too high. You know, like a dollar, an extra dollar on a blank tape is a little exorbitant.
Yeah.
And the other thing that people don't understand about the way the bill works is the wording of it is kind of tricky. In the Mathias bill, it talks about the extra income going to the copyright holders. Now, when people think of copyrights, they often think of a little C with a circle in it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, people who, that C with a circle is the copyright for the music. There's another thing on the record, though. It's a P with a circle, and that is the copyright for the performance. And guess who owns that? The record company.
Oh.
The songwriter. And what they're talking about in terms of a... Hold on a second, I got another phone call.
All right.
Well, you're going to have to hold. I got a lawyer on the other line. I got to take it.
Okay, sure.
When I spoke with... See, Gordikov has talked to me twice in the last month or so about the blank tape tax because he doesn't want me to say bad things about it. And the last conversation I had with him was him trying to explain to me what the record industry's point of view is on the tax, just, you know, so that I wouldn't hurt or embarrass anybody by saying things that other people in the industry would really hate to have me say. So I listened to him, and I took notes on what he said. And here, I'll give you the benefit of a few of those notes.
All right.
He's the one who gave me the estimate of between $200 to $250 million a year in revenue. And when I questioned him about the P copyright, he said, well, you know, the division of the money that comes in, even though the bill does not specify the division, it is not, if you look at it on paper, it doesn't tell where the money goes.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that he expected that the pool of funds would be divided up in the same proportion that the profits from a record album would be divided up. And let me tell you what that means in plain English. The P copyright holder gets 90% and the C copyright holder gets 10%. So this bill is of major benefit to the record companies and of much smaller benefit to the recording artist. And then I said, well, in the terms of the 10% that goes to the recording artist, how is that divided up? And he said, well, that's probably going to be based on actual record sales and, you know, that kind of stuff. Well, guess what that means? The big winners would be Prince, Michael Jackson, Bruce Springsteen, all the guys that are already selling millions and millions of units. And so the bill really does little or nothing to help a lower or mid-echelon sales artist. It just means extra compensation for those people who already sell millions of units.
Right.
And based on the theory like they, you know, they sold it, they earned it, which I can agree with, because any other kind of division would start to smell like communism. But we have to say that if a guy has already sold 30 million albums, say, in the case of Michael Jackson, how many people did not buy a Michael Jackson album and taped it from a friend in the case of a sales figure like that? Obviously, he did okay.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, so all the guys that are already selling large numbers of albums, are you trying to tell me that there is an equal number of people who didn't buy the record and just taped it from their next door neighbor?
So this thing is basically bullshit for the same reason you said Live Aid was bullshit. The money won't really go where it's supposed to.
Well, apparently there are other people asking the question, where did the money go? You know, I've heard things like it's still sitting in a bank account drawing interest while they make life and death decisions about which trucks to buy in order to take the food where it's supposed to go and
yeah.
Things like that. And then you have to say, well, where does the interest on the money go? And then you have to ask, who got the publishing royalties on the song? if they donate artist royalties, you know the difference between artist and publishing royalties and how that works?
Tell me.
Well, when a guy makes a record contract, the royalties that he receives are in a lot of different categories. For example, if a person writes and performs his own material and also owns his own publishing, he will be getting three different types of royalties from an album. The artist royalty, the writer royalty, and the publisher royalty.
Okay.
But they are not all paid in the same way. Before you can receive an artist royalty on an album, which is paid in percentage points, the album has to recoup what it cost to make it.
Right.
In other words, all the charges for the studio time, musicians, rentals, catering, whatever it took to make the album, that all goes against, that's in the red ink column, until the album has sold a sufficient number of units to break even. And then, after the break-even point, based on your royalty rate as an artist, you will then receive artist royalty. You follow?
Mm-hmm.
So that means that the record company acts like a bank. When you sign your record contract, the record company puts up the money to make the album, and they get paid back first.
And this is why you created your own record company, I assume.
Right. Well, it's not the main reason. It's one of the reasons.
Okay.
The reason is I don't like to have people fucking around with what I write. But the other royalties, the songwriter and publisher royalties, are not paid in percentage points. They're paid in pennies. And they're paid from the first record sold. So you could have an album that didn't sell enough units to earn any artist royalties, and the guy who wrote the song and published the music could already be rich by the time the accounting was done, you understand?
Yeah.
See, if your album cost $150,000 to record, which is, a fair average, and your royalty was $1 per album, which would be a high royalty, you would have to sell 150,000 albums before you got any profit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But that first 150,000 albums that didn't give the performer any profit would have yielded, let's say, anywhere between 28 to 50 cents per album in writer-publisher royalties. Cash.
28 to 50 cents.
Yeah. See, depending on how many songs were on there and how short the songs are, because the breakdown for the I forget what the rates are. I think it's like 4 cents a tune or something like that. Up to 6 minutes. So if you had like very short songs on the album, and a lot of them, your writer-publisher royalty could be high on the record. But let's take an average of, say, 24 cents a record, even 25 cents a record. You can see what the amount would be going to the songwriter and the publisher.
Yeah.
Now take an example of the We Are the World song. How many millions of units did that thing sell?
I forget.
Okay. Now ask yourself this question. Even if every artist on there donated their royalties to feed the starving people in Africa, who got the publishing and songwriter money?
Who did? Would that be Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie?
Whoever
Quincy Jones, yeah.
Whoever publishes it, that's where the thing went. Now, did anybody ever announce that they were donating the writing and publishing to the starving people of Africa?
Not that I recall.
Right.
Hmm.
I also understand that, I don't know which of these aid outfits it is, that is located in Los Angeles, but they have an office in Century Plaza with a yearly overhead of $600,000.
So where does that come from? Yeah.
Well, I mean, it came out of part of the money that people phoned in.
Uh-huh.
See, you remember the concert for Bangladesh?
Sure.
Did those guys ever turn out okay?
Where
did that money go?
Yeah. The taxes and big mess.
Yeah. See, if an organization, one of these instant save the world type organizations, gets formed, I think that they should also be publicly accountable for the money that they take from average citizens who just want to do a good thing. Okay? That's truth in packaging. They should, after the money comes in, the public deserves an accurate accounting of how much was collected, where it went, how much money was taken out for executives' overhead, so you can really see what it is.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you are exploiting the goodwill of the public when you do these things.
So that's why you'd rather not get involved in these?
Well, I don't know any of these people who are involved in this stuff. I mean, my experience with anybody in the record business has all been negative because basically the people have no scruples. And fairness is a word that very seldom appears in anybody's contract, let alone dinner conversation. And so, you know, when you get high-powered executives and megastars involved in things like this, you have to ask yourself, where does the money really go?
So are you still embroiled in those suits with Warner Brothers?
No. I've had, I guess, four major suits with record companies, and they've all been settled out of court.
Oh.
Most recent one was against CBS, and that was settled about 2 months ago.
Well, to get back to the PMRC here, I haven't got my Z-Pack yet, so correct me if I'm not up to date.
Oh, I can recite to you from some of the latest stuff that has come in that we just added to the Z-Pack.
Yeah, it went up to $1.50 now, huh?
Well, there's a lot of paper in there, buddy.
Yeah, I know. I haven't got it yet, but I can imagine. So there's 22 members of the RIAA that have agreed to either carry this generic warning sticker or print the lyrics on the jacket. And, well, you actually...
Yeah, but subject to the loopholes.
Uh-huh.
And the loopholes are, parents' groups will have no role in determining what is explicit. The record companies will determine what is explicit. A quote from Stan Gordykoff, explicit is explicit. There are no guidelines. And those artists who have control over their, contractual control over their album packaging are free to ignore the understanding.
Hmm.
That's all directly from the Associated Press Wire Report, November 1. So what really do we have here? The way I see this, the RIAA did the PMRC a big favor and let them save face by pretending to agree to something that is not really enforceable.
Right. Instead of the specific stickers.
Right.
But you actually beat them to all this sticker business when you put a sticker last year on the Thingfish, your warning guarantee.
I've had three albums out now that have that sticker on it, but I mean, look what that sticker says.
Yeah.
This album contains material which a truly free society would neither fear nor suppress.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anybody should give any more warning than that. As a matter of fact, you don't even need to put that on there because an intelligent person would know that music is not going to make them go to hell. Nor will it turn you into the Night Stalker. I mean, this whole business of them trying to connect the lyrics or performance of AC/DC with
the Night Stalker, yeah,
accused Mexican murderer is really preposterous. Because if you examine it this way, let's take other famous murderers in the United States, like William James Gacy, isn't he the guy that killed all those kids and concreted them into his basement in Chicago?
Oh, I don't remember that one. How about Charles Manson freaking out on the White Album?
Well, But if Manson goes berserk on the Beatles, then everybody else who heard a Beatles song, it's possible that they're going to turn into a Charles Manson.
Right.
So what I'm getting at is, all you have quoted is examples of people who committed murder and liked rock and roll.
Uh-huh.
There are plenty of people who kill who much prefer either country and western or other forms of music.
Right.
Okay, but the guy who killed the most would be Hitler, and his favorite was
Wagner.
So,
yeah.
What do we got here?
Bunch of nonsense.
You know, it doesn't really add up.
In retrospect, here, Joe's Garage was quite visionary. It like predicted the PMRC and this PASS, the Parents Against Subliminal Seduction.
Oh, I got another one for you.
Yeah, what's that?
Freedom Village.
No.
Package in the mail the other day from the Attorney General of the state of New Mexico. The guy is a fan. His father used to be my high school English teacher. His name is Bardicky. And he sent me this package because somebody had sent it to him. Now, do you remember when the hearings were held on the 19th? There were some news shots of kids picketing outside the Senate building.
Uh-huh.
Well, they were holding signs that said, "Stop murder music."
Stop murder music.
That's right. And I thought, well, that's pretty amusing. Where do these suckers come from? Well, here's the story. Apparently, somebody connected with the Senate committee or the PMRC or Reverend Jeff Ling or somebody involved in this invited these kids from a place called Freedom Village in Lakemont, New York. This is a detox center to cure children of rock addiction.
Oh, wonderful.
Run by a guy named Pastor Fletcher A. Brothers. Okay? And they had sent a whole busload of these kids down from Freedom Village to testify at the Senate. And apparently somebody, when they saw them and saw how extreme this whole thing was, they didn't put them on as witnesses. But they did let them march around outside with these signs saying, "Stop murder music." And they had this bus from Freedom Village endlessly circling the Senate building for 5 hours. So the other day, I get a package of stuff from Freedom Village. And in case, one second.
So the Freedom Village sent this to you, or you got a package about them?
No. I got this from Bardicky, the attorney.
Oh, okay.
I don't know how he got it, but he passed it along to me. It's got, you know, the whole schmear. And they've got a pamphlet attached to this thing that lists everybody in rock and roll that they think are major offenders and what it is they've done wrong. And let me give you a couple of examples. Stevie Wonder is on there because the album Songs in the Key of Life refers to astrology. Linda Ronstadt is on there, and the reason she's on there is because they've taken some quote of hers out of context that says, "I would rather shoot smack in both arms than sing a show on a full stomach." Okay? And then they've got The Who in there because Pete Townsend follows Mayor Baba, and they recorded a Hindu prayer on one album.
And that's objectionable, huh?
Right.
Oh.
And this is all under the heading of murder music. Their cover letter mentions murder music in capital letters, boldface type with quotes around it about 10 times. It also has Boy George in there. I mean, aside from the fact that they give the guy a bad time because he's gay, they claim that his music promotes Hinduism.
It does.
That's right. And the thing is full of typos. It's unbelievable. John Denver is on there. The reason he is on their shit list is because he belongs to EST.
Oh, yeah. The Earhart Seminar Training.
Right. And I think that most of the people who are on this list don't even know they've been targeted by these people. But the stuff is really extreme. And it comes complete with free type petitions that you're supposed to fill out and send to the FCC and senators and everybody. And they also tell you to mail all the stuff back to Freedom Village and they'll deliver it to Washington, D.C. I mean, you know, they want to get you on the mailing list and then exploit you as a mindless member of their organization. And in case you think this is bullshit, the toll-free number for Freedom Village is 1-800-VICTORY. And the cover letter says, "Feel free to copy or distribute this package to your friends." And that's one of the reasons why I am copying it and sticking it in the Z-Pack.
Oh, all right.
It's really a big wad of stuff.
So you've been telling people to register to vote a lot lately.
Right.
And, well, even as far back as the Live at the Fillmore album, you had that on there. And yet I read in an interview, maybe I shouldn't believe everything I read, but it said that that you said that when you voted for Kennedy, that was like the first and last time you voted. Is that true?
That's right.
But you'd want people to register to vote, not necessarily vote, but just register.
Well, see, if I've got something that I feel I really can exercise freedom of choice on, rather than the difference between Tweedledum and Tweedledee, you know, I'm personally going to go out there and vote. What my voting habits are has got nothing to do with me urging other people to register. Here's one of the reasons why you should register. Unless you are registered, nobody in Washington will pay attention to you. You don't exist. So why should you expect them to enact legislation that will suit the needs and wants of an 18-year-old voting bloc unless they know there are 18-year-old voters who could put them out of business? The people in Washington are there because they like to be there. That is their idea of a good time, being legislators. They want that power. And without somebody to give them the power, they're out of a job. Now, if kids don't pay attention to what's going on, they're going to suffer the results. They're going to grow up to be adults, and they'll be living in a country that has already had laws enacted that will restrict their ability to function freely in the society. And those laws will have been enacted during the time when they had the ability to change it and didn't.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just
a crummy example. I mean, this is really a cheesoid example.
Okay.
Elevating the drinking age to 21.
Right.
In all of those states where it was already 18 or lower or whatever, the people who had the right to vote at 18 could have kept their drinking age from going up to 21. They could have kept that from happening.
Yeah.
And what about one day when they decide to have the draft again?
not if, but when, huh?
Right. You know, if you're not registered, you can't say shit.
So you're still registered. You just haven't liked the choices that they've given you, say, for candidates in elections and all that.
The time that I was registered to vote for Kennedy, I was living in a different town. And I am not registered as a voter in Los Angeles. And one of the reasons for that is they require that you put on public record your home address.
Oh, on public record.
That's right.
Oh.
And that is a slight problem for me.
Yeah, big hassle. So, on Almost Live, that show you did with Richard Belzer, you said the politicians will dance to you.
That's right.
Yeah, do you think that
let me show you how that works. I mean, it's not just bullshit. For example, what if MTV started running regularly voter registration things, not just when it's time for the presidential election,
yeah,
day in, day out, okay? And what if there was a large upsurge in young registered voters? Do you not think that there would be a change in the rhetoric coming out of Washington, D.C., out of your local city council, out of every government porthole there was?
Sure.
They're not going to say or do things that you want them to do unless they know you can hurt them. This is not a matter of goodwill as far as these public officials are concerned. No, they will vote any way that it takes to keep their job. The main thing they're interested in is their job,
yeah,
and their power, their perks, their stardom. And if you can put them back in the fucking stock room where they belong, they're going to have to do things your way.
You think that this country's conservative climate is going to turn around as Reagan's term comes to an end, or you see it continuing?
Well, let me tell you about the conservative climate. You've heard the one about Reagan's massive mandate.
Uh-huh.
The statistics that I heard one time was that at the time Reagan was elected, only 15% of the eligible registered voters in the U.S. went to the polls. And out of that 15, 90% voted for him. This is not the biggest mandate in American history. This is not the country swinging to the right. This is a bunch of apathetic people who felt they had no choice, and most of them stayed home, and the result is Ron. And what he's been able to do since he's been in there, you know, because he took the gold ring, he has set up a press office in the White House that rivals Pravda. And so you'll hear it every day of your life while he's in there, how right-wing the country is and how terrific it is. That's all freeze-dried news.
Freeze-dried, yeah. Canned.
It's portion-controlled servings of Republican news items. And the Los Angeles Times is full of it.
Well, some more opinions here. So, do you agree with Thomas Hobbes that you think people are basically bad?
Yeah. My theory is like this. I have always preferred animals because they don't lie. And, occasionally they kill things, but they do it to eat, not because they're mean.
Right.
And if they are mean, it is because a human being whipped them and made them mean.
Yeah. Do you have an alligator?
I used to.
Oh, you used to? Not anymore? Oh, because one of my friends knew someone that babysitted for you, and at the time, I guess you had an alligator,
yeah,
little tank.
Yeah, one of those little ones who lives in a terrarium in the back porch.
Oh.
He used to eat hamburger.
So do you consider yourself...
We've got two turtles, seven cats, and two dogs.
Seven cats and two dogs. Wow. How many turtles?
Two.
Oh. So back to people here. Do you consider yourself a pessimist or an optimist, or would it be more like an idealist or realist?
Well, I'm a realist. I mean, I try and see stuff, you know, in terms of the way it actually works. And most of the time that doesn't square up with the way that I wish things would work. But if I lived my life based on the way I wish things were, I would be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, if I call the shots the way I see them, people who are a little bit more Pollyanna than me find that disconcerting. You know, they don't want to hear it. They just don't want to know.
Pollyanna.
If you don't know, then you are more likely to become a victim of the stuff that's going on.
Yeah. So, tell me, what were your parents like?
Well, my mother's still alive, and she's a nice lady who the only job she ever had in her life was being a librarian, and the only reason that she took a job was because my father had a heart attack. He was always the guy that earned the money in the family. And he was born in Sicily, and she was half Italian, half French. And they're both very Catholic, and my father, he had several heart attacks, and he finally died of one a few years back. And he used to earn his living in various ways, as a barber, as a teacher of history, as a teacher of mathematics, working in data reduction at Edwards Air Force Base. He worked for Aerojet General. He taught metallurgy at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. And he was a regular immigrant kind of a guy.
Regular immigrant. So is Francis Zappa your given name?
No, actually, for a long time I thought that it was, until I had to get a passport. Because when you get your passport, you have to get your birth certificate. And I was, because my father had always called me Junior, and his name was Francis, so I presumed that my name was Francis also. It's not, it's Frank. Frank Vincent Zappa Junior is what it says on my birth certificate.
Oh.
And that was a little revelation that I learned around 1967.
So you were born in Sicily?
No, my father was.
Oh, okay.
I was born in Baltimore.
Oh. So, were your parents very religious?
Yeah.
Are you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really? What denomination? Any particular one?
Nothing that you would be interested in.
Nothing that I'd be interested in? Oh, don't want to try me?
No, as a matter of fact, a person can be very, very religious without ever donating a nickel to an organized religion.
Oh, sure.
I put myself in that category. I'm also one of what they describe as America's 40 million unchurched individuals.
Unchurched.
Yes.
Would you say that?
I've also described myself as a devout pagan.
A devout pagan. Would you say that's kind of agnostic or something else?
Well, agnostic is a term that Christians invent for anybody who doesn't eat the whole Christian enchilada.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is, if you read the Bible, besides the dirty parts, there are, worthwhile philosophical concepts lurking in there.
Uh-huh.
However, it's been translated and filtered through so many points of view that one wonders what it really does contain, because especially with the new simple-minded versions that these fundamentalists have put together, where they've taken the complicated speech and simplified it to their specifications in order to make it easier for the illiterate to read. Who knows what's been done to that material?
How did you get involved in the music? You said in the liner notes on Freak Out that you were self-taught.
Yeah.
Is that right? So how did you start playing?
First instrument was the drums, and I started playing with a pair of drumsticks on a bureau in my bedroom.
And then it went to guitar?
Yeah, I switched to guitar when I was 18.
So of all the musicians that you've worked with, you've had some really outstanding ones. Who are some of your favorites?
Well, for all of our musicality, I'd say George Duke is probably one of the most outstanding.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Luther Underwood is fabulous. Vinnie Colaiuta is fabulous. So is Chad Wackerman. Tommy Mars is in a class by himself. So is Steve Vai. A guy doesn't get in the band unless he's really got something to recommend him. And a lot of times when they go out of the band and do their own projects, they can expand on what they learned while they're in the group and achieve some really good things. And sometimes they do albums that I personally don't enjoy, but other people enjoy. But I'm not a music critic. I'm a band leader.
So some people think you're a tyrant, though, when you're a band leader.
Well, they're entitled to the opinion, but usually people who would say something like that are people who have been dismissed from the band under disciplinary circumstances.
Oh.
If you have good self-discipline, you're not going to have any trouble working for me at all. I mean, if you work as hard as I will, then hey, you're going to have a great time. It's only guys who are basically lazy, and most musicians fall in that category, that have trouble in the band, because if you think my demands are stringent, think about the demands of the audience for what the band does. They don't want your bullshit. They want you to go out there and do something that amazes the snot out of them. You're going to do that with a bunch of lazy guys who don't practice. You know, and if you don't learn your part and deliver it properly night after night live on stage, then who are you letting down? Me? Yeah, you're letting me down, but you're also letting down all the people who bought a ticket to that show.
Yeah.
So my job as a band leader is kind of like being a referee. The audience, they want it a certain way, and I'm there to deliver it to them, because what happens on stage is not 100% of what I do. It's 100% of what I write, but it's not 100% of what I do. I have to have the discipline there to make sure that first of all, that the band arrives in the town that they're supposed to play in. That means you do have to wake up in the morning and get on the plane and go to the next one.
Right.
Even if you had a party the night before, okay? And you do have to rehearse every day before you play the show. And you do have to do a sound check. And you do have to avoid using drugs and alcohol so that you don't forget where the fuck you are when you're on the stage. Now, what you do at home is your own business, but you know, if you're on the road, you are going to perform up to your maximum capacity as a musician, or you're not going to be in the band. It's as simple as that. So if that's tyrannical, tough cuckus.
Tough what?
Huh?
Tough what?
Cuckus.
Okay. Let's see here. Do you like to read a lot? I really enjoyed your reference to In the Penal Colony on... We're only in it for the money.
Oh, the Kafka thing?
Yeah.
Well, I don't read a lot. Mostly, if I read at all, I read on an airplane, and I read news magazines, computer magazines, Scientific American, that kind of stuff. The bulk of my information gathering time is from television, and I've learned how to read between the lines and memorize what the political bias is of each of the channels you're looking at. And I can
Yeah.
Read the stuff through that, and you can almost figure out what happened.
Almost, huh?
Yeah, I had already read In the Penal Colony when I heard that one, so I got a big kick out of that.
Yeah, that one thing does sound like that thing scratching across your back, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. That's kind of like weasels ripped my flesh, too. That sounds like weasels ripping flesh. Let's see, Miles Davis. You met Miles Davis a long time ago, but he kind of snubbed you at the time, didn't he?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm sure he was snubbing everybody else in the room, too. I just happened to be the person closest by. It was at the Blackhawk in San Francisco, and I went there to see him play, and I just wanted to talk to him after, you know, just taking a break between sets.
Yeah.
And he just turned his back on me and acted real arrogant, so, okay.
Fine. So, fuck him, huh?
Yeah, right. I mean, I wasn't in show business or anything. There's no reason why I should bend over and kiss my ring.
Yeah.
I was just a normal human being who was enjoying what he was doing, and I wanted to tell him about it. And, okay, he did his Miles Davis thing, all right? Do it to someone else.
So, what was it like playing with John Lennon? And that was on his sometime in New York City. And what did he think of We're Only In It for the Money?
I don't know. I hardly ever talked with him. I only met him that day.
Oh, really? Just that one day and it got recorded, huh?
Right, because we had a recording truck there because we were recording the Fillmore album. That's when it took place.
Oh. Yeah, because on the sleeve for that album, he's got the Fillmore crossed out and written over. Have you seen it?
No.
Oh, okay. Because on the inner sleeve of the live jam, it's got the Fillmore cover scribbled over with the new song titles and everything.
Yeah, well, there's a funny thing about that. There's a song on that Sometime in New York album that they have entitled Jam Rag.
Yeah.
This song actually is King Kong, and they credited themselves with writing and publishing it.
Wrong, huh?
Wrong. And I talked to Yoko about a month ago. I said, Yoko, I believe a little error has been made here. You know that album? And she was real embarrassed about it.
Oh, yeah. Just a month ago?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I haven't. She had called. This was after the new music seminar in New York, place where I spoke recently. And she was at the thing too, but on a different panel. I didn't see her there. And after I made my little speech and then left, she called my PR office in New York, trying to get a hold of me. So I told the lady in New York to give her my number, and she called me up and wanted to talk to me about something else. And in the middle of the conversation, I brought this up.
Like, oh, yeah.
Oh, well, funny you should mention it.
So what do you got coming up on MTV Basement Tapes Sunday? Is it, like, actually a video?
No. I'm the host of the Basement Tapes.
Oh, I see.
Quinn and I. It's really going to be a funny show.
Martha Quinn and you, huh? What a pair.
Yeah. They videotaped here at my house last night. In fact, we shot for about, I think it was 8 hours. In my basement video room.